and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and my next couple of segments is going to be on raw foods. I decided everybody talks about it and everybody wants to do it, but everybody thinks that becoming raw means pulling a carrot out of your refrigerator, and it bores them so that their, you know, their diets don't last. So I decided to get a couple of experts to give us some expert information on where do we start, how do we do it, nutritional aspects of it. And not only that, but how do we make it taste good so that we can stay on a raw foods diet? So my first guest is going to be Brenda Davis, and we're going to talk about her book, Becoming Raw, The Essential Guide to Raw Vegan Diets. How are you, Brenda?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you so much, Eva.
So before we get started, tell us a little bit about you and how you came to do what you do and where people can find you on the Internet.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'll tell them where they can find me on the Internet. I have a website, and that is BrendaDavisRD.com.
So that's BrendaDavisRD.com.
That's correct.
Okay.
Right. So I am, as mentioned, a registered dietitian, and I've been a registered dietitian for pretty close to 30 years now. And I was trained very traditionally and started about 10 years after becoming a dietitian, became a vegetarian and very near vegan. And so did pretty much a vegan diet for about 20 years. And although I wrote a book called Becoming Raw, I'm not entirely raw myself. I still do some cooked foods and enjoy some cooked foods. But I definitely, writing Becoming Raw allowed me to dive into a whole new world that is really quite exciting and quite interesting. And so it's kind of like going from vegetarian to vegan. There's such huge transitions, and again, going from vegan to raw, there's so much more to learn. And I've written 7 books. I'm very interested in chronic disease like type 2 diabetes and heart disease, cancer, and so have some focus on those issues in the books. I co-author often with Vasanto Molina, and we're both registered dietitians, and we're very, very careful about having scientific peer-reviewed journals to substantiate what we say. So, for example, in Becoming Raw, we've got about 1,000 references. And so that's kind of a little bit about me. I do research in the Marshall Islands on diabetes, and that's a whole other topic that is you may want to ask me a little bit about that as well, because it's just amazing what's happening in the Marshall Islands.
We will definitely spend some time on diabetes. I can promise you that.
Okay.
the first question I want to know is, what is the difference between vegetarian, vegan, and raw? Is that what you said, vegetarian, vegan, and something else?
Yeah, and raw.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct. So vegetarian is basically a diet that you eliminate animal flesh foods. So there's no meat or fish or poultry, but you do continue to eat some animal products such as dairy products and eggs.
Okay, Brenda. Sorry about the technical difficulty. So
no problem.
Go ahead and pick up where you left off.
Okay, so I was just distinguishing between vegetarian, vegan, and raw diets. And basically, should I recap what I said about vegetarian, or is that all good?
You can go ahead and do it again, then he can just cut it out.
Okay. So, yeah, the vegetarian diet is a diet that excludes flesh foods but does include some animal products such as dairy products and eggs. A vegan diet eliminates all animal products. So there's no dairy, there's no eggs, there's no meat, fish, or poultry, no animal products whatsoever. And a raw diet actually doesn't even have to be vegetarian. There are some raw diets where people consume raw milk, raw meat, raw fish, but the vast majority of people who eat raw diets do eat pretty much a vegan diet, so no animal products at all. But the additional consideration with raw is that the foods are not cooked. It's completely uncooked diet, and there is some heat used, for example, with dehydrating, but generally the way that that we distinguish raw from cooked foods is the temperature at which the food is exposed to. And so most people will define raw as nothing heated above 118 degrees. Now, all of that being said, you can still have some cooked foods and be considered raw. For example, generally we consider raw anything 75% of your food by weight is raw. So still 25% of your food could be cooked and you could still technically be considered a raw food follower. And then the other is a sort of a high raw diet, which we usually define as anything that's 50 to 70% raw by weight. So that's another little bit of a variation as well.
Are there certain foods that we should cook a little bit?
Absolutely.
Like legumes and things like
Absolutely.
That?
There are certain foods that it may not be safe to consume raw. And you hit the nail on the head with legumes. Some legumes you can safely sprout. Other legumes are probably not safe to consume, even sprouted. And those legumes are the ones that are high in things like trypsin inhibitors and hemagglutinins, which can be problematic for people. So definitely the larger legumes are probably generally not a good idea. Chickpeas you can get away with including some sprouted chickpeas. You probably don't want to consume more than about half a cup to a cup a day at most, just again because of the trypsin inhibitors that they contain. But safe legumes, mung beans, peas are quite safe to be consuming. Lentils are safe to be consuming sprouted. So definitely the legumes are one category that you, including a little bit of lentil soup or something in with a raw diet, may not be the worst thing to do. And then the other thing that you may want to consider not consuming raw, and this would go for omnivores and vegetarians and vegans as well as raw food folks, is the common mushrooms like button mushrooms and portobellos and so forth. It's all right to consume very small amounts, but if you're consuming them on a regular basis, there's something in mushrooms called hydrazines, which are known to increase cancer risk or potential carcinogens. And they do need to be cooked to destroy it's called agarotene, which is the big concern in mushrooms. And so generally if you're raw and you want to consume some mushrooms, it's best to soak or marinate the mushrooms in some sort of acidic marinade and then dehydrate them afterwards, and then at least warm them in the dehydrator, and that will help to reduce agarotene content somewhat, but still not a food you should be eating raw on a very regular basis or in very large volume.
That brings up a question. A lot of people use things like maitake mushroom or maybe the maitake defracture. Are those, to boost their immune systems if they have cancer? Is that safe, or does it also cause that problem?
I believe those are safe. The ones that are high in hydrazines, to my knowledge, and I'm definitely not a mushroom expert, but from the research that I've seen, appear to be the more common mushrooms that we consume, like the button and the brown and the portobello mushrooms.
Okay, so they should research what they're eating.
Exactly.
Before they do it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, another thing I wanted you to talk about was alfalfa sprouts. Can L-canavanine, is that how you say that word?
L-canavanine, yes.
You say it can replace arginine. I have a question here. If you have a herpes virus in your body, it can cause breakouts. Will the other form cause breakouts as well?
You know what, I the alkanavanine, I have not seen any research to that effect, so I really don't know. But it's a very good question, and it would be interesting for someone to do some research on that.
Zargonine is so
maybe
good
somebody
for you.
Knows, but it just didn't come up in the literature at all.
I was going to say, you know, it's so good for you, particularly if you have heart disease problems, but you know, if you're going to break out with herpes, you know, cold sores or whatever it is, that's a problem as well. Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
What about
alfalfa sprouts? And I should just say, you know, for people, alfalfa sprouts are generally not a problem if they're clean. All sprouts, there's an issue if the sprouts are contaminated, of course, because you can get food poisoning from sprouts if the seeds are not clean and grown properly. But if you have clean sprouts, the alkanavanine is generally not a problem when you consume sprouts, sort of in moderate quantities, unless you have certain disorders like lupus, for example. It seems to be a significant problem for people with lupus, so they're generally advised not to consume alfalfa sprouts. But
why is it bad for people with lupus?
You know, we actually don't know. All we know is for lupus and possibly even some similar inflammatory disorders, for some reason, the processing, I think, you know, what I've gathered from the research is that it's possible that susceptible individuals are just using the alkanavanine in place of L-arginine more rapidly than other people, and perhaps their disorder makes them more apt to do that. I'm not positive, but there are, you know, a number of hypotheses about this, and we really don't know for sure, but we just know that it seems to be especially a problem. What it tends to do is lupus patients who are in remission may actually reactivate their symptoms and we've seen this mostly with people taking alfalfa tablets, very concentrated alfalfa. So it's not everyone that finds that their lupus gets worse, or that, you know, if they're in remission that it reactivates their symptoms, but there have been several reports in the literature of it doing that.
Mm-hmm. So what about sodium? How do you suggest people use sodium? Table salt, tea salt, sea salt, or just what are your thoughts on sodium?
Oh boy, that's such a that's
and the iodine issue of sodium as well. If you're not using,
well, that's the thing, is that it's a really, really difficult thing. And I know we hear about all sorts of different wonderful salts that are natural and they come from, you know, these wonderful places and they're clean and so forth. The problem is that we try desperately to get nutritional analyses, to get information on those salts from the companies, from, you know, our databases and so forth, and there is just very, very little available. And so certainly what we generally tell people is that you want to minimize, you know, you really want to make sure your sodium intake is, for most people, around 1,500 milligrams or less per day. That's really ideal, and it's quite easy to do that on a raw diet. The choice of sodium is really up to you, what you feel comfortable with, but just note that if you're consuming a sea salt or whatever you're consuming that is not iodized, that is low in iodine, you need to figure out where you're going to get your iodine from. And it's really important. We've seen people on raw diets with iodine deficiencies. So it's really important that you just know where it's coming from. And you have a number of choices. Seaweeds are actually a very, very rich source of iodine, especially kelp. And so you can actually buy little containers of ground-up kelp that you can use as a kind of a salt replacement. And it's very rich in iodine. All you need is... Some people, depending on the type of kelp and the company that's processing it, anywhere between a tenth of a teaspoon and 1/16th of a teaspoon will give you your 150 micrograms of iodine per day, which is what you're aiming for.
That's very interesting. I'd never thought about using kelp as a salt replacement.
Yeah.
I don't like table salt. It does bad things to you, I think. So I use sea salt, but I put iodine inside my sea salt in the bag and shake it up to make sure I get that.
Oh, great idea. That works.
Yeah. So the next thing I want to ask about is if you're doing a vegan or raw foods diet, how are you going to get your oils, your omega oils?
Well, you know what? One of the beauties of a raw food diet is that you are not heating oils, right? So your oils are in such good shape in comparison to people who are cooking their oils before they eat them. So you can use the same sorts of things to get your omega-3. So, for example, your omega-3s, the richest sources are chia seeds, flax seeds, walnuts, hemp seeds. These are all very, very good sources of omega-3. So you can use the seeds. Now, with flax seeds, you have to grind the seeds for your body to be able to extract the omega-3s from the flax seeds. But certainly, that's an option. And you can consume walnuts. You can consume the whole nuts and seeds. Or you can use the oils. And generally, if you're on a raw food diet, you would want cold pressed, organic oils. And that's quite a reasonable option too, using a little bit of that in a salad dressing, for example.
And could you explain to us about the kind of nuts that we have to use? If they've been heated or processed, does it make a difference? Because even though they say raw, they're not always completely raw, are they?
That's true, especially certain nuts, for example, cashews, have to be heat treated apparently to make them edible and to remove any toxins and so forth. So they, even raw cashews, are technically not raw. Most of the other nuts and seeds you can purchase raw, and the very, very best way to consume them is by soaking and or dehydrate. I mean, you can soak and just eat them soaked, but the other thing to do is to dehydrate to make them crunchy and more palatable again.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's ideal.
If you've in the States anyway, the typical nuts that you buy at the store have been irradiated. Do you get the same benefits from those nuts?
Oh, I understand that they're irradiating almonds in California, but I'm in Canada myself. I did not realize they were irradiating them all over the state.
I don't know if they do all the nuts either. I was really thinking about almonds because I found a source to buy completely raw almonds, just fresh off
Wonderful.
The tree, but I have to buy them in very large quantities. And so
yes.
I just wanted
and
people
then
to
you
understand
freeze.
You're not always buying raw nuts just because it says raw.
That's right. You're not. And so obviously, and if you're in California, the chances are very good they're not raw, that they're irradiated. So that's certainly an issue. And we don't really know what the consequences of consuming irradiated food might be over the long term. We really don't know. We don't have adequate studies, so it's a little bit of a crapshoot, like genetically modified foods. We don't really know what the long-term consequences of consuming genetically modified foods is going to be. It's like when you throw something into the ecosystem, there's no getting it out. And so if we find out 20 or 30 years down the line, this stuff is not very good for human health, which I expect we will, it's almost impossible to get it out of the ecosystem. So it's like a huge experiment on humankind.
I have a very strong opinion about GMOs. I mean, when they modify them, it puts an extra electron in there. That electron's going to bond with something.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to float around and bond with something, and it's going to make something bad happen because it's going to bond to something it's not supposed to bond to.
Exactly.
You know.
And so exactly. I mean, we really don't know. We don't have, we know it's probably not going to be good, but we don't have the hard data in the peer-reviewed literature and so on most of these genetically modified foods. So we're just, it's like a huge experiment on humankind, which we will get the results of in, you know, however many years. And at that point, we're screwed. We can't
take it
out.
Yeah, I'd just like to say,
out.
If someone is sick, this is my only personal opinion I'm injecting here, I'm sorry. If someone is sick and you're trying to use raw foods and to get well, if you have cancer or whatever it is you're trying to do, please choose non-GMO foods. If you're really serious about wanting to get well, because you're going to have a much higher success rate to do
I
that.
I completely agree. Yeah.
Okay. Talk about, and this is something I'd never thought about until I bought my juicer, and I tried to juice some kale, and I went, you know what? There must be another kind of juicer to do this because this doesn't work. So can you educate us on that?
Well, you know, it's definitely not my area of expertise. All I can tell you is what my own experience has been with juicers. And I've had two juicers. I've had Champion and I've had the Green Star. And they both juice kale absolutely beautifully. I was part of another book called The Raw Food Revolution Diet. And in that book, there is an expert by the name of Sherry Soria, who's a chef and an expert on all of the practical aspects of raw food diets. And we have some sections about juicers in there. But what I would, you know, there are centrifugal juicers, and there's masticating juicers, and there's all, you know, the twin gear type juicers. The Green Star is a twin gear kind of juicer, and the thing that I love about the Green Star is there is very little pulp left in the product after you've juiced it. It extracts the liquid just brilliantly, and it doesn't heat up very much. Any greens does absolutely beautifully.
That's
so,
good to know.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, when you're putting a kale leaf in or even a romaine lettuce leaf, you put the tip of the leaf in and it just sucks the rest of it down. You don't even have to push it. It just sort of goes automatically. It's the neatest thing. So and the Champion is pretty decent too. It's not quite as expensive as the Green Star, but these juicers are, you can buy a $100 juicer, but you're getting a $100 juicer. They're not great. These sort of more high-tech juices like the Green Star and the Champion cost, I would say probably the Champion is $300 or $400 and the Green Star may be closer to $500. But definitely probably cheaper in the States than in Canada.
I was frustrated because I was finding all of my grain in my waste bin, you know. So I knew I wasn't getting all the benefit from it.
Yeah, okay. That's no good.
Let's talk about diabetes, because I really do want to talk a lot about that. That's a terrible epidemic that's going on with the adults and the children, and I'd like for you to talk.
Okay, well, I'll start out saying that type 2 diabetes is 100% preventable. This is a disease that never needs to happen. And
Wait, start over. You just kind of disappeared. So the question was, what is prediabetes and how do we recognize it? You just kind of went away.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't even hear that question. So prediabetes is a state that where your body is actually producing plenty of insulin. That's not an issue. But the insulin is actually not working properly anymore. And so your blood sugar starts to rise. And it rises beyond what's normal, but somewhere between about 100 and your fasting sugar will be between about 110 and 126, or 125, I should say, right before diabetes, which is a fasting sugar of 126. So the sugar's high, you've got plenty of insulin, but that insulin isn't working properly.
So how do you feel if you have that? If you don't have a tester, how do you feel?
Yeah, a lot of people don't really feel much different. You may find at these stages, you may find that you're going to the bathroom peeing a little more frequently, that you're thirsty.
Okay.
And it gets worse. The higher your blood sugar goes, the worse that gets. And so those are two probably of the most common things that you'll notice. You may feel a little sluggish, but certainly thirsty all the time. Because your body's trying to dilute the sugar that's in the bloodstream.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what role does hypoglycemia, if any, play with diabetes?
Well, you know, quite often when people have problems with maintaining and even blood sugar, they have problems with at both ends. And people that have struggled with hypoglycemia sometimes end up with problems of type 2 diabetes because their body isn't dealing with keeping blood sugar at normal levels.
Have you ever, do you know anything about using glycerin for hypoglycemia? And the reason I'm asking is I interviewed this man the other day about hypoglycemia and addiction. And he said, if you have hypoglycemia and you use glycerin, you know, when you start feeling that drop, that it metabolizes differently from sugar or from glycerin. Not glycerin. What's the one they use? The tablets people use? What are those things? Those
sugar tablets? Hypoglycemic agents. Yeah.
Or the diabetic, what are those things? Glucose. That glycerin metabolizes differently, and so you don't get the spikes and drops with glycerin, so you don't have the cravings that you do.
Right.
Do you know anything about that?
Well, you know, I've heard murmurings about it. I've never, all of the diabetes conferences I go to, I've never actually seen a scientific presentation on the topic, but I think it's definitely an interesting. It's a sort of a syrupy kind of sweet liquid. But do you find it widely available where you are?
Well, I just go and get the kind that you use to make cake icings and things. And I found this information, just for your information, from a researcher in Australia named Jurian Plessman, P-L-E-S-S-M-A-N.
Okay.
And he's written some fabulous papers on it. And he's found that he started out as a parole officer in prisons. And he found out that when he started, that a lot of them had hypoglycemia and they were addicts, you know, drug addicts, alcoholics, things like that. So he started using glycerin with them and he was able to, I hate to use the word cure, but basically cure their addictions because it stopped their fluctuating blood sugars and they stopped craving. And I was just, his papers are amazing. It really is.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm going to look. It's just something that I haven't heard a lot about in the past.
I hadn't either, but I have hypoglycemia, and my boyfriend has some mood disorders, and so does my daughter, and I started using this technique, and it radically made a difference.
Really?
Yes, it did. It was amazing.
Well, that's very interesting.
We stopped having those gigantic mood disorder. My daughter actually found out she had a drug issue. And so we started doing this to keep her blood sugar levels and her cravings went away. And she's been able, she's only 17, so she's been able literally to kick the habit by balancing her blood sugars.
Huh.
It's really been amazing.
Well, very good to know about.
So let's go. So what is diabetes and how can we prevent it? Can it be reversed? And where do we start?
Okay, well, let's see. Where do we start? First of all, what is diabetes? Well, diabetes is a disease in which, for some reason, you're not able to manage your blood sugar levels. And generally, with type 2 diabetes, the situation is that you actually make insulin. With type 1 diabetes, you don't make insulin. The beta cells of your pancreas that produce insulin are just dead. They're not functioning. And so you require insulin injections in order to survive because you must have insulin. Insulin is kind of like the key that opens the doors of your cells that allow your cells to use sugar as energy. And so you absolutely have to have insulin. Now, with type 2 diabetes, you produce insulin just fine, but for some reason, the insulin isn't doing its job. And what happens with type 2 diabetes is as your blood sugar rises, your pancreas, it sends a signal to your pancreas to put out more insulin. So you actually, in the early stages, have what they call hyperinsulinemia. You're producing massive amounts of insulin. And so that's, you know, it's quite interesting because so many people think, well, I have diabetes, I don't make insulin, but that's not actually the case. Your insulin is not working properly. And it seems as though also the fatter you are, and especially if you have fat around your abdomen, you know how people that have those big bellies, some people have big hard bellies and some people have big flabby bellies.
Mm-hmm.
The people with big hard bellies are more insulin resistant than the people with big flabby bellies because the fat inside their belly is in and around their vital organs and it makes us even more resistant to the insulin we're producing.
I have a question here.
Yep.
About those big hard bellies. When I see somebody that has a big hard belly, the first thing that comes to my mind is that they're having food allergies and can't digest food, and so they're bloating up with all this gas that they can't get rid of. So there's something more to that? Because I know that's true. So what you're telling me is there's something more to it.
Yeah, oh, there's much more to it. And as a matter of fact, you do see some people that have distended abdomen because they have a lot of gas and such. But these people aren't, this is quite different. This is where a person, genetically, where their body is going to store fat. Some people tend to store fat at the surface of their skin. And that's called subcutaneous fat. Some people store fat, it's called visceral fat, in and around their vital organs. And people that store fat in and around their vital organs are at much higher risk for heart disease and for type 2 diabetes.
Interesting.
And so that you know, you look at your body type, and you know we talk about the apple shape versus the pear shape.
Mm-hmm.
And people that tend to carry their weight in their legs and hips have a much lower risk of type 2 diabetes and of heart disease. People that carry it in their abdomen have the higher risk. However, if in their abdomen it's in and around their vital organs, in other words, the visceral fat, they have an even higher risk than the people with the flabby stomachs.
So why is it that diabetes and heart disease walk hand in hand? You almost always see the two together, especially in older people.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of the reason is just that people with diabetes, when you have elevated blood sugar over long periods of time, it damages blood vessels. It damages big blood vessels, it damages little blood vessels. And that's part of the disease of diabetes. But also, that's just one part of it. The other thing is that both diseases are diseases of diet and lifestyle. And so they're diseases of not getting enough physical activity and taking in too much bad food. Processed food, a lot of animal fat, and a lot of salt and so forth. So the diseases are so similar. They both often, you're looking at high blood pressure, and so many of the risk factors for heart disease, it's just the same, you know, the exact same things that are causing the problem for people in both diseases. So it's not, you know, a diet for heart disease and a diet for diabetes and, you know, an exercise program mm-hmm. for heart disease and an exercise program for diabetes. It's exactly the same kind of diet and exactly the same kind of exercise program that's going to help people in both cases.
Okay, I have another question here regarding supplemental nutrition. Would it benefit, and I've got three of them that I want to ask you about specifically related to this disease. Would it benefit you to use vitamin K for your vessels?
You know,
vitamin
K is extremely important. It depends on what your diet looks like. If your diet is low in vitamin K, then yeah, that would be important.
So how would someone know if their diet's low in vitamin K?
Well, vitamin K is the most concentrated sources of vitamin K are the, you know, your dark green leafy vegetables, and so that's, you know, that's if you don't eat a lot of vegetables and you don't eat a lot of dark greens, you're probably not getting that much vitamin K.
The reason I ask this question is my best friend is a surgeon, and she's got some diabetes, and I have some high blood pressures, and we were talking one day about pharmaceuticals that doctors give you when you start having high blood pressure issues, and one of them is Norvasc. And I said, you know, every pharmaceutical is trying to mimic some natural thing. And my doctor tried to get me to take Norvasc. And I said, what is it trying to mimic? I'd rather take the natural thing. She said vitamin K.
Yeah.
So it made me wonder.
Certainly we know that vitamin K is hugely, hugely important to human health. And certainly if people are taking, you know, anticoagulants, then, vitamin K is a coagulant. So it's a bit of an issue if you're consuming a lot of vitamin K, you end up having to take more of the anticoagulant. But apart from that.
Or could you take niacin or something with it to be an anticoagulant?
That's a little debatable. You would really need to check with your physician if you're taking a bunch of different things, and whether or not niacin. I mean, niacin probably.
But there's a lot of things. You know, one thing it'll do is thin out that blood.
Yeah, and you know, so will fish oil, for example, or omega-3s. But certainly vitamin K is hugely important to bone health. We know that. It's important to heart health as well. But I would recommend that people, rather than necessarily taking it, that they include plenty of sort of the dark green leafies in their diet. And even things like legumes, our lentils and peas are a reasonable source. Some sea vegetables are a very reasonable source of vitamin K. So if you're consuming a plant-based diet with lots of, you know, the green veggies and legumes and sea vegetables and so forth, you're probably getting plenty of vitamin K.
Okay. The other two I wanted to ask about was vanadium, vanadil, and chromium.
Yeah.
What do those have to do with diabetes, and can they help you? And could a diabetic I hate pharmaceuticals because you take the pharmaceutical for one thing, then it gives you liver damage or impotent, you know, whatever the thousands of things that you hear on the television. So could a diabetic possibly use those things to not have to take pharmaceuticals? And if so, what do those things do for you?
Well, it's, you know, both of them, there are a number of benefits. But in both cases, particularly with chromium, it helps with insulin sensitivity. So that's extremely, extremely important.
What does that mean?
Makes your insulin work better.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what does vanadium do? What's the difference between vanadium and vanadil?
Between vanadium and chromium?
Vanadil.
Vanadil.
Yeah.
It's probably just a different form of the mineral.
Oh, okay. And what will that mineral do for a diabetic, or do generally?
Well, generally, again, it helps with the functioning of insulin.
In
so,
what
in
way?
Both cases, they improve the ability for insulin to activate the receptors, so that the blood sugar can be used. So again, it's an insulin sensitivity issue.
It's one of them. I'm one of these people because I love alternative health, but I'm one that I'm extremely aware of what happens in my body, so I play with things a lot. And I take chromium and I feel good. I take vanadium and I would get these things where I'd almost pass out. So is one of them does more than the other one, or does it do something different? Or do you know? Those two
They definitely have a little... Yeah, they're both important. Generally, most experts would say use both. but they're not exactly the same in their mechanism of action.
How do they differ?
How do they differ? I'm not sure.
That's okay. Chemistry. I mean, if you don't know, you don't know. I'm intrigued by these two minerals.
Yeah.
Okay. So we got about 15 or 20 minutes, and you can have this time to talk about what you want now that I've asked my 100 questions.
Okay, well, that's great. What I'd like to talk about mainly is I'd like to talk about what we're doing in the Marshall Islands, because I think it's just a little bit of a story that will help to inspire people to make some important changes in their lives and protect themselves and their families. The Marshall Islands are about 2,300 miles southwest of Hawaii. And the Marshall Islands, the folks there about 60, 70 years ago, there was no diabetes in the Marshall Islands at all. They were diabetes free. Today, about half the adults are diabetic. And I would guesstimate about 90% are either diabetic or pre-diabetic.
What happened to
exactly. Good question. What happened? Well, what happened was these people went from being completely living off the land, and they had for generation after generation. They ate coconut. They ate green leaves that grew on their island. They ate bananas and pandanus and breadfruit and just wild plants and fish, and that's all they ate. They had no processed foods at all. And, of course, to acquire those foods, they had to work hard. They had to work hard to catch the fish with their spears. They had to work hard to climb the coconut trees and then to crack the coconuts and grate the coconuts. And so it was hard physical work just to survive. Today, over time, they ended up, progress happened, I guess you could say, which is horrible, but they ended up becoming more, as some people would say, civilized, with roads and taxis and cars and stores, and foods began to be imported, and of course the employment, there's no jobs for people, and so they need cheap food, and so they were buying, basically living on, I'll tell you what their diet looks like. Adults, it's donuts and coffee in the morning, white rice and meat for lunch and dinner. They wash it down with a beverage called luau, and the luau is number one ingredient is high fructose corn syrup. And that's all they eat. They eat some white crackers and some white bread and some, just refined carbohydrate junk foods, and the white rice and meat. And they love processed meat like Spam and canned corned beef and so forth. All the parts of the animals we don't want. Go to poor countries like that, the turkey tails and the pig's feet and the pig's tongues and everything else. And so that's their diet. The children, there's no concept of nutrition whatsoever. The children, their number one favorite item is ramen noodles with Kool-Aid powder sprinkled on top.
Really?
Yeah, and then quite often I saw a kid sprinkling white powder on top of the Kool-Aid powder. And I asked someone, "What in the heck is that?" And they said, "Oh, that's Acinomoto." I said, "Acinomoto? MSG, pure MSG."
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So take dry ramen noodles, which are deep fried salted noodles, pour Kool-Aid powder on top, and then sprinkle a little MSG.
Oh,
and
wow.
That, so they went from eating among the healthiest diets people could eat to eating one of the worst. I couldn't design a diet to induce diabetes any better than the diet these people are consuming. And so it's just completely, completely bad news, because they're not doing any physical activity. They drag their feet. They barely even lift their feet off the ground, drag their feet into the grocery store, take the money out of their pocket. There's no exercise involved. And so they have become one of the leading, populations with the leading rates of diabetes in the world. And the number one surgery on the island is amputations due to diabetes.
Oh, my.
And so, you know, you're looking at a population that is wiping itself out. And when we look at their population, we are not that far behind. They are at higher risk for diabetes because they're genetically designed to survive famine. When they stop exercising and start eating crappy foods, they die faster than we do. But we will die too, eventually.
Yeah.
And you can see the rates of diabetes in North America are skyrocketing. They just are a few steps ahead of us in that regard. And so basically I became involved in a diabetes research project there where we feed these people 3 meals a day and get them exercising and teach them how to prepare foods in a healthy way. And we compared that to sort of standard, you know, control group with standard care and did several interventions. And what we see in 2 weeks' time is people that have been suffering for 10 or 20 years with, you know, the pain in your legs, that you
yeah.
can't even sleep at night. We call it intermittent claudication, where circulation in the legs is so bad you can hardly stand it.
Mm-hmm.
Within 2 weeks, that's gone. It's absolutely gone. They have no pain anymore. Their blood sugars drop probably on average at least 50 to 100 points.
50 to 100?
50 to
100. Oh.
Yeah.
I was going to say, wow.
Yeah. And so their sugar starts to normalize. Their average cholesterol drop is about 33 points. Average triglyceride drop is about 45 points. So you can just see everything, the blood pressure starts to normalize, everything starts to get back in order. And one of the things that we've seen is in a number of our patients, the diabetes completely reverse itself. So these people are off medication, their blood sugar is completely normal, and they're fine. And so it's just getting them back to a more traditional diet. People in the Marshall Islands can't eat the traditional diet anymore because the main island that they're on, it's called Majuro, it would maybe sustain 500 to 1,000 people. There are 30,000 people on that island now. So they have to import some food. And so what we're trying to teach the government is to import foods that will support their health rather than kill them. And so what the point we're at now is almost all of the politicians have been through our program, and they've turned over the hospital food service, they've turned over the public school health curriculum, and they are at this point in time proposing some taxes to the unhealthy foods and to take taxes off the healthy foods to make.
What a great idea!
So we're just really looking at what we can do to turn the epidemic in this country around. And we, you know, I'll just give you an example. We had one fellow who was 30, maybe 35 years old, who was a pilot. And in the Marshall Islands, getting educated is a huge thing. Not very many people get well educated and become professionals like a licensed pilot. And he had a family, two kids and so forth, got diagnosed with diabetes, and what that means to a pilot is you can't fly anymore because you fail your medical. And he was devastated. I mean, there was nothing else he could do to support his family. And in desperation, he came and joined the program, and within, you know, a month or two, his blood sugars completely normalized, and he went back probably 6 months later and was retested and was told he was no longer diabetic. No medication, completely normal blood sugars, and doing very, very well. He's flying again.
So no matter how bad it is, can it be turned around?
You know, that is such a great question. And unfortunately, the answer is not always. It depends what stage you're at. In the early stages of type 2 diabetes, probably the first 10, 15 years for most people, It really is quite reversible generally because your insulin production is fine. You need to lose weight to restore insulin sensitivity. You need to look at the food you're putting in your body because every single cell of your body is a product of what you put in your mouth. And the cell membranes, when you're eating trans fatty acids and all the garbage in processed foods, your cell membranes get stupid. They just get stupid. And so the insulin can't work properly on stupid cell membranes. And mm-hmm. and it makes your body very insulin resistant. So the nice thing, the good news, is that your cells turn over on a very, very regular basis. And so when you start putting healthy foods in your body, you have to think of food like think of food as though your body is a house on fire, and food is either gasoline or water, and you don't want to put a drop of gasoline on the burning flames.
Mm-hmm.
You want to
what
put
about
water
glyconutrients? Are they beneficial to diabetes?
Glyconutrients could be beneficial to diabetes. But I don't think they're to me, the most important thing in diabetes is you need to reduce inflammation, because you can't restore insulin sensitivity when you've got all this inflammation happening.
Mm-hmm.
You need to reduce body weight so that your insulin can start working properly, get rid of the visceral fat that is increasing your insulin resistance. So, you know, these are the things that you need to get in place. You need to exercise regularly, because that helps your insulin to function more efficiently. So all of these things. And so in terms of diet, what did we do? Well, the diet was loaded with vegetables and fruits, a lot of antioxidants, a lot of phytochemicals, a lot of anti-inflammatory foods, making sure we get the essential fatty acids in the diet. And so we did include things like flax seeds and walnuts and so forth, but we did allow for some clean fish as well. In our actual program, the diet was actually completely vegan.
Okay.
High fiber, very high fiber, but we allowed for fish because it's such an important part of their tradition.
We've got 1 or 2 minutes. I have a question.
Okay, you bet.
Would you choose flax oil over barrage oil or vice versa?
Yeah, barrage oil is omega-6 GLA, and so both can be quite important. GLA is actually important for insulin sensitivity. I would say you need to do a little bit of both, or some source of GLA.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, we're at the end of the show. That was a great show, by the way. Thank you. Very informative.
Oh, thank you so much.
Tell us again where to find you.
I'm at www.brendadavisrd.com. And certainly Defeating Diabetes is the book that I did on diabetes that you may want to take a peek at as well.
I think I have that. In fact, I do have it sitting here on my desk. And you're going to come back soon, according to your publicist, and talk just about that book.
Sounds
so
good.
So thank you for coming on. I appreciate it. And
thank you so much, Dana. And
let's go over that book.
Okay, thank you.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Asher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health. Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health. Consciousness health.
Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr.